Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Police departments today have a number of very sophisticated tools for tracking crime, and there are many people who would argue that the development of these tools and their implementation played a major role in the crime drop that we saw in the 1990s. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll talk a bit about that idea and talk with Peter Manning. He spent 6 years studying police departments around the country to test that claim. And in fact, one of the things that he believes is that maybe these innovations didn't transform police tactics as much as might be expected. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Peter Manning about his book, The Technology of Policing. The subtitle is Crime Mapping, Information Technology, and the Rationality of Crime Control. It's published by the New York University Press and looks at the changing world police departments and the role that information technology plays in crime management. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome as we talk this morning. Our guest Peter Manning is the Elmer and Eileen Brooks Chair in Policing at the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University. He's the author of a number of books, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as I said, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief as possible so we can get as many callers in as possible. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana if you're going to give us a call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you'd happen to be listening around Illinois and Indiana, over the air, across the country on the internet, use that toll-free line. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Professor Manning, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Happy to be with you. My pleasure.
And I hope you will forgive me if we pitch this at a kind of a general level.
Sure.
Obviously, the technology of policing is a scholarly work, and it's aimed at people who study criminal justice and policing and so forth. So, if you wouldn't mind, we'll go at it at a more kind of basic level. Well, having said that, I certainly want to talk about crime mapping. But before that, I wonder if it would be possible to talk a little bit about policing in the United States. Now, I realize you could write a very big book on that, and we could talk for a long time about how over time the philosophy of policing has changed. But if you were to ask something like, well, say within the post-war period, so say even just take the last 50 years, what would have been the major benchmarks, the major points at which certain kinds of philosophies were articulated, and how maybe over the last couple of decades at least that changed?
Yes. Of course, as you say, we have an enormous number of something like 50,000 police departments in this country. But I can make 3 points. The primary change came in the early 70s with the development of 911, and then later on that being federally funded. The idea then that that people could call the police from anywhere, given that set of numbers, and have an immediate response. That drove the idea that that policing on demand was now a part of the police rhetoric, that is, you call, we haul kind of notion. That has continued to be incredibly influential with the rise of more systematic computer-based dispatching. And 911 reverse, so that you now know the address of any caller that's not on a cell phone. The second major change came in the 80s with part as a result of my student Bob Churjanowicz's interest in community policing, the idea being that you would reduce social distance, create partnerships, create more police presence in neighborhoods, and really the underlying issue going back to the Kerner Commission in 1968 was the marginalization, destruction of police community relationships that had occurred over the previous 10 or 15 years. The third thing that if I could say, it's probably been the influence of rational approaches to crime mapping and analysis, so that you have online data that makes more makes it more accessible to examine trends, particularly short-term trends. Those three things have, in my judgment, primarily the impact of those has been to make police more responsive, and rather than to alter much about their general practice. Mm.
So you don't think, I can imagine some people perhaps being concerned that the third kind of approach might undercut the second, which, I'm sure some people would say, community policing, this was a good thing. You get officers in the community. Yes. They get to know the people get to know them. They're watching, they're looking. But what you do with mapping is, if what you're doing is, say, identifying crime hotspots and concentrating on that, it sort of undercuts the community policing idea, which, as I say, a lot of people would have said, well, that was a good thing.
Yes. That's an excellent question. First of all, community policing floundered a bit because the actual way in which it was expressed and explained was confounded with crime control and crime crackdowns. Basically, the notion was, as it's most effectively done in Chicago, by the way, with the work of Wes Scogan and others, has been the most successful community policing enterprise in this country, but it is an exception because of the support of the mayor, the support of the city council, the support of budgets and overtime that made it possible. Second point, however, about crime mapping is, you're quite correct. If you have a more rapid capacity to identify hotspots, which are largely focused in disadvantaged areas of cities and largely focused on narrow variations in a few noticeable crimes, largely robbery and burglary and auto theft, that is inconsistent with the notion that you have partnerships, that you have long-term developments, that you have a presence that's benign and available. This kind of work and policing leads to crackdowns, sweeps, operations, and arrests, which often sweep in many, many innocent people simply because you're now using curfews, parole violations, and a number of other things that in many ways are overlooked in the interests of the interest of reintegrating people and sustaining some kind of peace in disadvantaged areas.
And I suppose that also what that does is it leads to a mindset that identifies particular areas of your city and particular kinds of people with high rates of crime.
Absolutely right. And let's say this. The average patrol officer on the street is a very shrewd, reasonable sort of fellow, man or woman. They are aware that the job is to maintain public order, not to crack down on crime. If you have a policy that drives policing in the interest of these narrow spikes of focus on a few crimes in a few areas, you increase the inequalities in those areas, and you are not dealing with drunken driving in the suburbs. You're not dealing with public order and disorder that may be of concern but isn't easily labeled. One of the reasons community policing floundered was that there was no way to assess whether it was working. Everyone agrees, as you've well stated, it's an important a philosophy and approach, absolutely essential, and it's swept this country and had, I think, considerable impact in the everyday organization and rhetoric of policing. However, the absence of some way that you could assess, is it working, means that people fall back, particularly the media, present company excepted, on the officially recorded crime, which is approximately half or less of the actual crime in any given time.
Our guest on this hour of Focus 580 is Peter Manning. He's on the faculty of the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University, and in his writing and research specializes in looking at things like community policing and the use of information technology in police departments, and also crime mapping and crime analysis. He is the author of the book The Technology of Policing, and that is published by the New York University Press, taking a look, as the subtitle suggests, at crime mapping, information technology, and the rationality of crime control, and takes a look at particularly this issue of how it is that crime mapping was implemented in a number of big cities in the United States, Boston, Washington, one other city that is described but not named. I have this feeling that if you knew that city, the clues would be enough. You'd say, "Oh, I know what that is." But it's not in the book. It doesn't say what city it is.
No, it is in the Midwest, but nevertheless, yes. And just to say, my primary focus was on Boston, and ironically, the epilogue of the book points out that because of Homeland Security and other notions and change in commissioner, they no longer have these meetings of the same order. Mm. So whether or not they had an impact on crime raises the question, if they did, and I'm not convinced they did, why are they being abandoned or simply used as daily briefings, much like roll call? That's what's happening in D.C. That's what's happening in other cities. You used to have a roll call with major figures there, spend half an hour saying burglaries are up in the District 7. That really doesn't add to a change in policing practice. It simply amplifies it.
Yeah. Well, one comes away with the impression maybe that if you take a look at how these departments functioned, and if you said that the one that seemed to, at least at the time you did the study, the one that seemed to function best was Boston, it was maybe not so much a matter of the technology that we're using. It was all about the leadership of the department.
Yes. You know, I'm, as a sociologist, I'm not inclined to take great leadership positions, but yes, the way in which the leadership, the commissioners, the commissioner and the top superintendents, the 26 who are the major figures, were very open to this, and they unlike New York, it was a very low-key, supportive discourse around how to address what was going on. It was not deep problem solving, but unlike the New York notion, it was not a matter of embarrassing the heads of districts, the captains, or shaming people into action, but rather an encouragement to recognize the problematic and uncertain character of policing. And in that sense, yes, it was a leadership, and that was carried on through two commissioners, Kathy O'Toole and Paul Evans. The present commissioner, Mr. Davis, is very enthusiastic about it, but the meetings, as I observe them, are no longer held.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about crime mapping, and it's interesting. This is one of these approaches to public order that comes out of New York and of a certain time. It was this time when William Bratton, who is now heading the police department in Los Angeles, he was the head of the police department in New York City. And it was developed in New York, and a lot of other big cities and departments looked at it and said, well, this looks like it's a good thing. Let's implement that. Let's just talk very basically about crime mapping and what it is.
Yes. Correct. Actually, in the 1920s, the University of Chicago began mapping areas of the city, and was associated with the great Chicago School of Sociology. The idea of mapping was then developed first through dots, which would fall off when you rolled up the map or unrolled it, to then pin maps using pins, which were very common even when I started doing my research in the late 70s in England. Pins were used. What crime mapping has there are two aspects to it. First, the capacity to take an address and geocode it, and then put that address or whatever characteristic you give to it onto a map, and to use various scales so you can zoom in and out, and to, as it were, collect the dots in a particular area. So, for example, if in the course of a week or a month, a particular intersection or block face has a series of incidents, it can be shown. One of the problems there, briefly, is that, of course, the dots overlap each other, and you have to then look at the numbers and compare them to over time. The second, so you visually can now display these maps for any area of the city, any block, and zoom down to very detailed analysis, including a particular block face. I've been shown my own block face while I was in a meeting in Boston and saw that there was a burglary around the corner. So that kind of thing is quite, it's dazzling, it's fascinating, it's remarkably vivid, and officers have concrete knowledge, and it lights up their eyes immediately. Ah, I know that corner, I know that place, I know those people. The second thing is crime analysis, which has not been developed adequately in any police department. It's simply been called crime analysis, but it's largely making up tables and lists. That's not analysis. That's tabularization and listing, and that can be done by any reasonably competent high school student. What had happened is Northeastern students, for example, with master's degrees have been hired, but they're largely doing listing and mapping. So analysis would suggest that you want to look at trends, and behind those trends, for example, an increase in burglaries, behind those trends, what might be causing that? Is there a change in the resources available, new number of cars in the lot? Have there been a change in people's pattern of locking their doors or movements? Have there been a transition in the neighborhood? Have there been new groups of people coming in who are less likely to contact the police? That's problem solving. That's what's absent in these meetings. You get a beautiful map, you see that burglaries are up, and people say, yeah, more overtime, more cops. Now, that's not innovation. That's the same old, same old.
Well, this, I'm sure that this is a remarkable tool with the ability to collect and collate a variety of information and attach that to a geographic area.
Right.
You
know,
so that would be very useful.
Right.
Particularly when you only have so many officers and you're trying to figure out
right.
where it is you want to concentrate your resources. You can't
right.
spread them out over the entire city. And it's useful if you can say, okay, here are particular places that we've got to pay attention to.
Yes.
I suppose one could imagine that that the technology could be used, or one would think, can you actually use that technology not only to talk about where crimes are going on now, but
yeah.
to make some kind of projection? So if you're thinking about where, not just where we should be looking at today, but
yeah.
where we might want to look at next week and next month, and is that stretching things too much to think that kind of analysis could be possible?
That's a very interesting question. First, I want to emphasize, as you did previously, that the way in which it's been used is largely to identify short-term spikes of what I call traditional 19th century street crime. Assaults, shootings, robbery, burglary, auto theft, but primarily the violent personal crimes that are concerned. So that has been the practice. Secondly, it's very clear, if anyone who knows a large city knows exactly where crime is concentrated. And Peter Moskos has recently written a wonderful book called Cop in the Hood. I think he's actually been interviewed, but here on NPR.
Mm-hmm.
Cop in the Hood makes the point of, in high crime areas, you can make as many arrests as you have time to do the paperwork. There's absolutely no limit to the number of arrests that can be made. So the question really is, can you use problem solving and thinking about the kinds of conditions that change crime? What can we do that might alter the ecology or the presence of people or the kinds of repairs that the city could make to areas? That kind of problem solving could lead to prediction about change. And that's a wonderful question. Basically, police are not interested in prediction. They're going to do the same old, same old. Like any other occupation, they learn what they do it well, they continue to do it. But prediction, in the sense that you're discussing it, would require problem solving. And that, in turn, would require, sorry to go on a little bit here, would require more expert knowledge. We know that Boston Police Department has about 30% civilian employees, experts, forensics, lawyers, lab people, crime analysis, computer engineers, and so on. As the population becomes more educated, the civilianization of policing will go forward, and that's how the expertise will be applied to things like prediction or problem solving.
Yeah. We talked about how you can imagine and understand how the ability to map crime and collect this much information and make it available very quickly would be an advantage, so that you could take you can put a laptop in a patrol car, and with a couple of keystrokes, the officers can have access to that information. So that obviously that you could see that would be valuable.
Yep.
But at the same time, I guess I would find myself wondering within any administrative zone, whether that's the district or a precinct or whatever, whether the officers and their commanders would know all this already. As you say, they would say, well, I don't need this computer to tell me where the crime is.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Originally, my notion was when I first came to Boston that I will first study crime analysis as I did in this book. And then I would follow up. I would go to a district. I would go to two districts, and I would look at the trickle-down effect, not to be vulgar, but what would happen as does this information alter in any way practices on the ground? My sense of it is precisely what you've said. No, because officers believe they already know it. They know what the job is, which is answering the next call. They know that their job is defined in terms of solving this incident in the here and now and cleaning up things at the end of the shift. They find it rather insulting to be told that they should be looking at X or Y in their districts when they're very well aware of it. They chat with each other about it. They see it day after day. Again, that's why the trick is in some way how to incorporate the street knowledge of officers into the analysis. And occasionally you get an officer who comes into crime analysis or into the and actually raises some questions. Would patrolling with dogs make a difference in the rate of burglary? Would more undercover officers in a particular area alter the open dealing? If we could include that and bring that wisdom into the analysis, we would have a great step forward. But you're quite right now. There's a tremendous resistance within the rank and file, the below middle management, to any of this kind of thing, any abstract theorizing, mapping, and so on, because the job is seen as in the here and now, applying the skills I have to what I see. Mm. That's it.
Well, I suppose that that does indeed raise the question that this kind of technology or other kinds of technology, surveillance technologies and so forth that are being discussed and implemented various places around the world, whether in fact any of that takes the place of what's come to be called the boots on the ground, if you don't mind that phrase.
No.
And that is you have to have people out there either on foot or in cars and there's no substitute for that.
I will say that one of the most important writing on policing is a book by Egon Bittner, and where he talks about the concrete knowledge of officers on the street. Actually, over the last 30 years, that's diminished radically because the old hands are now retiring. They've been 20 years, 25 years. And we have now about a third or more of the new departments now with new officers, most of whom immediately go on patrol. They lack the concrete knowledge that would have been present even 10 or 15 years ago. Secondly, the ability to actually apply that concrete knowledge, as you said, is a particular skill. As officers, my students who've had master's degrees and courses here at Northeastern are going out, and they're much more sophisticated, verbally articulate, much more competent in computers. That will probably change things in the long run more than centralized modes. Second point, which you've already raised, is most of the evidence about surveillance is it's used ex post facto. Most of the time people are asleep, they're not watching the screens, they're not. If an event happens, they go back over the video, if it hasn't been covered over, and try to attempt, as they did in London with after the terrorist bombing. But most of that does not prevent in relevance to anyone, and it doesn't increase people's sense of well-being either. The studies in England show by and large, it makes no difference in their well-being or in their fear of crime. And conversely, it's not used in any proactive sense to alter, but rather to use in the reactive way that we now use 911 and other modes, responding as and when. And in that sense, it has been valuable. But it's a symbolic and dramatic gesture rather than an instrumental one.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Champaign, and this would be line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You're doing a wonderful job on the program today, but this is more of a curiosity question because I used to live in the Chicago area. I worked in Chicago, and I've moved down here quite a few years ago. But in terms of the police, you mentioned, well, okay, in terms of this corruption, and I didn't, this recent thing where there was a whole thing, and I don't recall the whole details because I don't pay as much attention to Chicago as I did, but why did this occur? It seems this comes up every once in a while. Do you know what the point I'm focusing on or not? I'm trying to think of, was it back in terms of the police department? The
corruption?
The corruption, yeah, the big one. Scandal, and I don't recall the full detail. It seemed like when I lived in Chicago, and I was there quite a few years, that same thing happened, if I recall, in terms of what, why does this happen particularly? It's a great department, but what happens there?
Mm-hmm. The interesting, I'm not sure about the event, what I would say is that in large cities, there's a constant pattern of temptation and involvement with criminal element, an easy way to make money, to bend the rules, and in particular, policing that involves a secretive surveillance or activities such as narcotics or vice. Because the police officers are trusted with lots of money and often involved in violent circumstances or with drugs, there's a constant exposure to opportunity to act in illegal ways. So you get periodic corruption, as you mentioned, around vice, narcotics, because there's so much individual entrepreneurship and trust in the individual actor. I've done a book called Narc's Game about it. But there's also a tremendous pressure on police to make arrests when the public is concerned about things so that the evidence may be weak, but there's tremendous pressure to, we'll make an arrest, let the court sort it out. I'm not sure, but it's more common in big cities in part because there are much more likely to be exposure to a variety of opportunities for drugs, money, sex, and other human temptations.
Yeah, I think there also were the, I just remember vaguely the clips in terms of beating people up in bars,
yeah,
a whole bit. You know,
yeah.
It's sad because, Chicago does do a good job and all of a sudden it really taints it. Good, excellent program.
All right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I mean, certainly, as the caller suggests, from time to time there are in the news, there are stories about police misconduct, police misconduct, what they do in their off hours, the fact that they can take advantage of their position to commit crimes themselves, how with the techniques they use to interrogate suspects, the use of deadly force, all of those things, and particularly they come up a lot in big city departments, maybe not surprisingly, having said all that, if you track the effectiveness and the conduct of police departments over time, do you see that any more or any less? Or I suppose there are some people who would argue that as in other fields, there has been this attempt, at least over the last century, to professionalize the police department and to try to at least to develop and hold people to some kind of standard of conduct.
Yeah, there are two things. On the whole, I think policing is far more, let us say, benign, appropriate, less violent in every respect. 30 years ago, the level of shooting of officers was 10 times what it is now. Officers shoot fewer times. They're shot at much, much less often. In spite of the concern about violence and the level of violence in the citizenry in this country, policing and police contact has been vastly improved by non-lethal weapons, by training, and by the educational level at which people are more articulate and more able to perhaps weigh the consequences of fatal force. But the second point I'd make is that policing, of course, by definition, cannot be transparent. This is a nonsensical idea. They're a secret organization. They're based on secrecy. Their secrecy is essential to what they do because they can't reveal all of what they're up to or why in order to engage in an investigation. So this is a naive idea, and neither are any corporations transparent, just by the by. But what has happened in the last 10 years, beginning with Rodney King, let's say 15, 17 years now, is the rise of mobile media, of cell phones with photography, of digital cameras. The idea, in fact, the police are the YouTube, all of these international-based. This has, in fact, made policing much more transparent. So the media escalates and amplifies those things. We really don't know how frequently these beatings have ever been taking place, but we now have much more available of visual evidence, which in this society is a very, very powerful mode of persuasion. The second point, not to go on about this, but the fact is black people in general, African Americans in general, because their experience with policing is negative, for the majority of their experience are negative. Do not, when they see things on television, they simply amplify their notions about what is being done. They know a third or 40% of the people they know have also experienced unfair treatment, violence, corruption, rudeness, disrespect. And however, the white population in general, and this is data from Washington, D.C., but also national data, don't alter their view of the police. In general, they tend to view them positively, 80%, and it doesn't change when these egregious beatings occur. So there's something very fundamental about the division in this country about experience and so on with policing. And police are well aware of this. And they know that these things are amplified incredibly and that the consequences are great, more in the relationships that they're engaged in every day than the average person who's watching it on the media.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Peter Manning. He holds the Brooks Chair in Policing in the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University and has done a lot of writing and research on policing, community policing, the uses of information technology in law enforcement, crime mapping and crime analysis. And that is, in fact, the subject of his book, The Technology of Policing. The subtitle is Crime Mapping, Information Technology and the Rationality of Crime Control. It's published by the New York University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to a moment to return to something,
sure.
And I think you've really answered this question, but I kind of want to underscore
sure.
it because it's one of the questions you take up in the book, and that is
yes.
that a number of approaches to, as I said, a number of approaches to the issues of law enforcement and public order that were implemented in New York City in the 90s got a lot of attention because it also was a time when crime incidents went down, and some people had said, well, look at this. Look what they've done. The crime went down. Must be connected.
Yeah.
And so the question is, well, things like crime mapping, crime analysis, the what has been called the fixing broken windows approach to order where you deal with low-level crimes with the idea that it sort of trickles up, all that kind of stuff that came out of New York. Did that, in fact, was that, in fact, related to the downturn in crime, or was that something else?
It's an extremely subtle, complicated question, complicated to answer. It appears that most of the impact in New York came from the addition of some 12,000 officers over the period of about 18 months. That had been going on under Dinkins, and it was added to by Giuliani. Those officers were put in, quote, hotspot areas in which they made a lot of misdemeanor arrests. Now, how that affects the long-term crime rate, no one is quite clear about whether or not it did, whether or not how that works. But clearly, the number of officers has had an impact. Steve Levitt, who, the Freakonomics man who's at Barr Foundation at University of Chicago, has done the most sophisticated analysis, and his notion is that there were really three major changes, and smart management, broken windows, and the rest was not one of them in his notion using correlational analysis. First was simply we had 1.2 people in prison, that there had been this incarceration frenzy for about 20 years, and that an enormous number of people, about two-thirds of those in prison in New York State, are from the city of New York. It was an enormous impact of simply incarceration. That's probably the primary element in crime drop. The second thing that's argued is the change in cocaine and the cocaine markets, which led to violence and competition amongst people. That's a plausible one, which seems fairly strong. A third one is birth rate, simply a change in the demographics. That is, fewer people between 18 and 24 who are, of course, the primary sources of crime. And finally, the economy, in general, its positive effects. The short answer is, no one really has articulated how it is that crime mapping and sending officers to make more arrests, which by definition increases crime, could have been a source of reducing official crime. And the claims made by Bratton and others are entirely based on the books of the New York Police Department, which are flexible in their characteristics and have long history of cooking the books. And the marginal changes those changes were also occurring in Los Angeles and in other cities which didn't have that same tactic. So it's still an open question. It's a terrific question, but there's no evidence that crime mapping and crime analysis was a source, nor has anyone explained how that might be the case.
Let's take another caller, someone who is here in Urbana where we are. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting discussion there. Bring it up to date a little bit here. I just heard on your news broadcast a while ago that the Supreme Court did shoot down, literally, the anti-gun laws in Washington, D.C., and which may cause Chicago to have to change theirs. You know, and the response of one of the aldermen, who also is a professor of something or other, was that there will be blood in the streets. But, you know, 48 states already permit their citizens to carry guns.
Yeah.
Illinois and Wisconsin are the only ones that don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never seen a problem in Indianapolis or Louisville.
Right.
So where do they get this idea?
That's a terrific point. Let's say two things. First of all, police officers can always, under normal constitutional search, can search and frisk for guns under any circumstances if they suspect it. So these laws really have no bearing on the practice of policing. And secondly, I agree with your general sentiment. This is an overstatement. It's not going to alter one way or another the practices of young, disadvantaged, violent kids.
Right.
It's not. There may be some changes, and in this sense, unfortunately, I would agree with the NRA. If you start making more difficult licensing and all the rest, it actually impinges mostly on the average person who would like to carry a gun or would like to go to a gun shop or trade in guns. The final point is that, of course, anyone in this country can get a gun at any time or place within an hour. I usually ask my students, how many of you can get a gun within an hour? Virtually everybody in class, and this is Massachusetts.
Yeah.
You can be sure that this is having no impact on the circulation of guns. People who are engaged in routine violent crime, trade guns, use guns, carry guns. They don't carry them if there's a crackdown, but no one in this country has any problem finding a gun. So these are symbolic issues, and I agree with your point that we really have to be careful about overemphasizing the relevance of law to changing these practices. And the fact that it actually impacts much more likely the average homeowner and the average person who is interested in guns. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, the one just one follow-up
sure.
thing. In policing in general, you know, my understanding is that the modern type policing started with bobbies in
yes.
in London. But, you know, we see there was a letter in our paper a few months back about how this gal wanted to use GPS
mm-hmm.
and to prevent crime. I think maybe that was mentioned something, but uh-huh. you know, she was saying, if I had a button on my phone I could push that would give my location immediately when this guy's trying to steal my purse, then a cop could be right there to help me. And
yes.
You know, well, I live in a section of town where we have fairly light policing because we have
yes.
light crime.
Yes.
And I know darn well, you know, yes. that sometimes, and I've seen our whole department
sure.
at one scene of a shooting one night,
sure.
you know, and
sure.
anywhere else in the town, they would not have been able to react.
Right.
And unless the guy happens to be 300
sure.
feet away when he gets the call.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That kinda not, that's nonsense.
No, you're it's a wonderful point. I would say two things. First of all, this technological conceit, the idea that more technology increases response, makes better policing, is an empirical question. We know that perhaps response time is reduced, but response time is not really a measure of anything of importance. Secondly, what you're talking about is very important. Policing tends to be disproportionately in the ironically, there are fewer police officers in high crime areas than there should be, and there are more police officers in low crime areas than there should be, just in, you know, theoretical and abstract terms.
Right.
That's not to criticize the, but simply to make that observation.
And if you get
yep.
more officers in the high crime areas
yep.
than the citizens,
yep.
they're complaining about it.
That's right, and it leads to more incidents, which one generally wants to reduce. You know that, in addition to that, I think it's very, very important for policing to educate people about the importance of reporting and responding in outside the context of simply I press my button and you call. You know, go to
right.
meetings, go, send letters, make phone calls, be in touch with your local officer if there is such a person, and so on. And I imagine this is the kind of thing you're talking about. You can't simply expect. We also know, and for better or worse, that in high crime areas, police are pressed a lot. And basically, the notion in those areas is the cops don't come. We call them anyway, but they don't come. They're overloaded. They're overworked. They're not always enough, and so on. So the irony is that in those areas, yeah, there's a lot of call for the police. It's not that people are unwilling to call. It's just that the workload is sufficient to make it impossible to cover all the calls.
Hmm.
Even in best, you know, best effort.
I want to thank the caller. We had just about 5 minutes left
sure.
In this part of the show. And here, I guess it makes me think, how do you find some kind of mid-ground between accomplishing the goals of community policing and having police, at least some police presence visible at some time everywhere, and the opportunity for people in the to get to know the officers and the officers to get to know the
yeah.
territory, that kind of thing, and yet acknowledging
yeah.
the fact that you have scarce resources, and
yeah.
given that, what makes sense is concentrate your resources where you know
yeah.
the crime is, which
yeah.
was, and knowing where the crime is the goal of the crime mapping. And it seems
yeah.
to me that I'm not sure you can do both of those things.
I don't think you can. I think, for example, James Q. Wilson, who's a fairly famous, well-known expert, has argued as a conservative that you really want to put your resources in high crime areas, concentrate on that, and so on. There are two points to make about that. First of all, if you increase that, and you increase the average number of arrests by an 18-year-old African-American in Chicago, felony arrest, is one. That level of arrest produces inequalities that are unacceptable in democratic society, and regardless. So if you concentrate, you're going to then increase the inequalities in those areas that are most disadvantaged. And conversely, you're going to be taking away from the problem-solving capacity that you need. You need smart men and women thinking about this instead of going out, knocking on doors, and putting people in jail. So you're asking some terrific questions, and I think administrators have to begin to... That's why I think, for example, in Boston, every time there's a series of homicides, one or two, we're still at the same level we've been for several years, they would say, well, there will be more patrol. Well, patrol has no impact on homicide. So let's step back and think about the problems that are at issue. Boston is actually quite unusual, so Chicago, in the ability to put some resources behind the problem-solving process. And that's a great credit to both those cities and to the commissioners in both cities. But it's unusual because the most common idea, as you've already suggested, is throw more cops at it. And that simply is not a solution to crime. It exacerbates the problem.
Have you had the opportunity to take a look at law enforcement in other countries that are wrestling with the same issues and also have looked at the same, particularly you know, how it is that information technology like crime mapping can be incorporated in what they do?
Yes. My work in England gave me some insight. There are two points there. First of all, the English have gone into far more specialized and dedicated units and specialized and dedicated databases because of the federal centralized home office system. They're far better able to concentrate on problem-solving and intelligence-led policing, as they call it. The Dutch are extremely good at this. The Germans are extremely good at this. We are very poor because we're a revolutionary country with 50,000 separate police departments, with 50,000 separate agendas. That's the wealth of this country. It's the beauty of our decentralized revolutionary society. But it is also a cost when it comes to trying to centralize and act specific in a coordinated fashion with reference to any problem, crime, terrorism, or any other. I think it's kind of strengths and weaknesses. We're inventing the wheel every day, but that's not a bad thing.
To ask, this is another subject in a sense and worthy of another conversation, but I'm interested, since we're talking about technology and policing here, and we've been talking about information technology and gathering collating and juggling various kinds of data.
Yes.
If a big issue, and I'm sure a big issue in big cities, maybe everywhere, is resources. Has the increased interest in various kinds of surveillance technologies to, in a sense, give the law enforcement more eyes so they can watch more areas that then they can put people into, has that actually yielded any kind of positive benefit in terms of crime reduction?
That's a terrific question. Clearly, cities are very enamored of this. In Boston, we have now, in the most disadvantaged areas of the city, by the way, only, exclusively, oral monitoring for gunshots, as well as surveillance cameras, as well as patrols and seven other kinds of specialized units as well. In general, the surveillance modality is increasing on the internet and as well as interpersonally. There's no evidence yet that this has any impact. Those studies have been done in England. I'm not aware of any studies in this country of it. The problem being that it's a generalized deterrent stimulus. How do you identify that the particular camera was the reason that crime reduced or that someone acted differently or that patterns of crime changed? Very, very difficult methodologically to establish that. Even if you were to have experimental areas, you know, one with surveillance cameras, one without, you would still have to match them in some way that would be very difficult given the vagaries of policing as an activity and the recording patterns, which are in themselves entirely within the control of the police. So unless and until you could control vertically what it was you were measuring and control it, you won't really be able to know. But we know they're very popular with the city, with city council, with the average citizen. They believe because this is this is the idea of the middle class, that deterrence and rational long-term planning works. The future has a relevance. The future has no relevance when you have no job, when you have no home, when you have no savings, when you have no education, and you have no chance to do that. The future has no meaning.
Yeah.
So it doesn't deter anyone in those circumstances, and those are the people most likely to, unfortunately, commit the crimes that are most concerned to people.
Well, have there been cases, say, for example, in Boston or any place else, where you could say that as a result of this technology, you identified the suspect or perhaps someone who is found to be, in fact, guilty of a crime that otherwise you might say, we wouldn't have caught this person otherwise?
Yes, and again, on a very important point, justice deals with unequal phenomena, and it may be that capturing one or two serious bank robbers or killers or terrorists may well be worth the millions of dollars spent and the inconvenience that is an important question that has to be raised. And there is evidence of this, yes, and you're quite right. It is something that must be weighed, and certainly in the terrorist activity in London, the video surveillance was extremely important. And there's no question, if you could alter that pattern one iota, it would be worth all of the stress and strain and money and so on. I think the unfortunate part of it is that the way in which surveillance is now organized is typically to add already to disadvantaged areas the modes of surveillance and not to be useful in no evidence to be shown in other areas, that public parks and so on, where the level of crime is low anyway, and it may or may not have value. But you're asking a very interesting question.
Well, at that, we'll have to stop. Our guest is Peter Manning. He's on the faculty of the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University. That is in Boston. He is the author of the book, The Technology of Policing, published by the New York University Press, and has also done a lot of writing and research on use of information technology in policing, on community policing, and also on crime mapping and crime analysis, and that's really what the book is about. Professor Manning, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I've appreciated it. I hope I haven't gone on too long.
Thanks. No, I've done a great job. Thanks.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.